Welcome to Season 5 of the Prosthetics and Orthotics Podcast with Joris Peels and Brent Wright. We're bringing in industry experts, patients, vendors, and thought leaders to share their stories, insights, and visions for the future. Whether you're a clinician, a researcher, a vendor, or someone with a personal interest in the field, we have something for you. Join us as we delve into how advancements in personalized healthcare and 3D printing are revolutionizing the industry and changing the way we approach the design, production, and delivery of prosthetic and orthotic devices. Welcome to the Prosthetics and Orthotics Podcast with Joris Peels and Brent Wright, brought to you by Advanced 3D, your trusted contract manufacturer for all your 3D printing needs. From intricate industrial components to custom orthoses and prostheses, Advanced 3D excels in delivering high-quality, innovative solutions. Hey, y'all, listen, you only have me today. Joris is actually flying, but nonetheless, it's going to be an amazing day. But I know some of you want to hear Joris' voice, so I created an AI clone of what he said to us today. Take a listen.
Hey, all, I can't tell you how much I miss being able to join you on the show. I am flying today and will be doing big things, consulting with some of the biggest companies in the world looking to adopt 3D printing. However, you are in semi-good hands with Brent, so Brent, take it away.
Okay, Joris. Kind of fake Joris. Today we have Arthur Finiston, one of the originals in the digital space for orthotics and prosthetics. And I can't wait to hear his journey of how he got into the field. His ABC number is triple digits. So if that tells you something, it's that he's been around for a little while. And I think that's pretty neat. His father started a clinic back in the 20s. So I want to hear about some of that as well. So, Alan, thanks for being on the show. And I'd love to hear how you got started in the field.
Well, I was born in it. My father, Arthur Finiston, actually immigrated from Scotland and lived in New York. And he actually wanted to be a doctor and didn't have the money to be able to do that. And he somehow went to work with a hospital up there that was named the Hospital for the Ruptured and Crippled, which is now the Hospital for Special Surgery. And he did what would be known as apprenticeship up there. He then moved to Florida because he was in the Marine Corps and stationed in Haiti, and they used to do the R&R in Miami, and he liked it. He didn't like the cold weather and so forth. So he ended up moving to Florida and started his clinical practice, which was Arthur Finiston, later incorporated into Arthur Finiston, Inc., and we were DBA as Arthur Finiston Clinic. And so he had been involved in a lot of pediatrics in those days because of the polio problem, and had a great friend in an orthopedic surgeon that was from the Illinois area. It was a farmer's son that became an orthopedic surgeon. His name was Dr. Arthur Weiland, who started the Crippled Children Commission in the state of Florida. So I kind of grew up with that. Dr. Weiland had four girls. My dad had two girls. And then this boy came along, which was me. So I was the fair-haired kid that got the attention of being the male in the group. And Dr. Weiland had significant intuitiveness as a physician, And, you know, in those days, they didn't have specialization of pediatric orthopedic surgeon. That's what he specialized in. And so my dad arrived in Florida, and he went in to see Dr. Weiland, and he said, "Dr. Weiland, I'm a brace maker from New York, and I got my training at the Ruptured and Crippled Hospital," and that started a very, very close relationship between Dr. Weiland and my dad. So regarding myself, I look at old pictures at my dad's shop, as we called it in those days, and I would go down there and play, and I wasn't allowed to use power tools, but I would take the old drop-offs of the Ohio willow wood or basswood from the artificial limbs, and I would carve and make boats out of them. So basically, I started my hand skill at an early age of about 6 years old. And fast forward, I was in the military, in the Army, at age 18 and a half. In those years, we were obligated for 8 years via the law. In other words, every male had to register with the draft board at 18 and a half years old. So I was in the reserves and went in for 2 years and was a combat engineer, which is something you don't want to be, because your life expectancy in combat's about 60 seconds because you go in before everybody else does. Anyway, I exited that in February 1960, and I went to work for my dad. Note, before that time, I had entered the University of Miami as a engineering student, and that's how I got stuck in being a combat engineer, because the Army didn't understand the difference between an engineer and what they know as a combat engineer. So I started my career in February 1960. So last February, I will have had 63 years in P&O. Been a very rewarding field and profession for me. As a kid, liked to see how things worked, and I would take them apart and put them back together. So I had a pretty good mechanical aptitude going into the field, and working for my dad, I developed, you know, very, very good hand skills. I attended NYU and Northwestern is where I got my formal education, and then a number of continuing education, short-term courses, et cetera, throughout my career. At the time that I entered it, we were dealing with significant amounts of post-polio patients, because the Salk vaccine, I think, which came into use was around 1952 or 53, something like that. So that was the beginning of the end of polio in the United States, which was a wonderful thing. Fast forwarding, after completing my courses at those two universities, I was in attendance of the crippled children's clinics, which were held 2 days a week at the Variety Children's Hospital. Then it became Miami Children's Hospital. And then recently, in the past, I think about 6 years, 7 years, it became Nicholas Children's Hospital. We had clinics on Wednesday and Thursday, half a day each day, where we had in attendance two pediatric orthopedic surgeons and a resident and myself. And we would see 45 to 60 cases in an afternoon of all pediatric cases of all different orthopedic problems in those days. I had a system that I developed. This is BC. That's not before Christ. That's before computers. That I had templates made up so that a doctor would prescribe what is now known as an AFO, a short leg brace with the various different types of ankle joints and stops and positions and so forth. The knees were all made out of metal and leather, and nobody really knew anything about plastics in those days. So I would, out of those 45 to 60 cases, I would see anywhere from 10 to 15 cases each day out of a clinic. So I had a system, which is what we built our later computer technologies on, where we had templates made up for the prescriptions that the doctors would write. And I had my cards printed up with the dates, or a date that the patient was given for an appointment to come in. And the efficiency of it was, I mean, really great compared to what you would have to deal with today. The prescription was the gold, so to speak, because this was all processed from the doctor's prescription, not particularly his notes, but the prescription, and all of the paperwork was generated from the Florida Crippled Children's Commission. So in many instances, what the doctors would do is, for an example, they would prescribe bilateral short leg braces, i.e. AFOs, and the children would be serial casted for clubfoot problems. So when the appointment was made, I would bivalve the cast, measure the patients, put them back in their cast, and they had their braces in approximately 1 week. Today, that can take anywhere from 30 days to 2 months before all the paperwork and getting your patient in and getting them fit with their orthoses. A lot to be said for the old way of doing things with a much more efficient system, not burdened with the paperwork scenario that we now have to go through. During this period of time, I developed a lot of systems and technologies. Going forward, I hold, I think, like 22 or 23 patents that, you know, those patents are over with, and we developed a system of miniature joints for pediatrics, which we used for years. And I ended up selling that to United States Manufacturing, USMC, for their product line, because we were manufacturing them from stampings and investment castings. But I saw the light coming down the road here in plastics and switching to AFOs and et cetera, which ultimately took place. But typical of the O&P industry, they're very hesitant to sign on to new technologies. I continued that again for about 23 years. We were also doing a lot of scoliosis at that time, and I was trained at Marquette University on the CTLSO in those days, which was the use of molded leather and Manel iliac crest indentations that you would have to hand hammer, and metalwork and the flat occipital and chin piece that would flatten the child's jaw, create problems with teeth protruding out. So the answer to that in those days was to not only brace the back, but brace the teeth. Then a development came out of Marquette, I think it was, with what they called a throat mold. And then that eliminated the teeth problem, so we didn't have to brace the teeth any longer. And then ultimately, Bill Miller from Indiana moved to Boston Children's and developed the Boston Children's or LSO modules, et cetera. And today, it is very rare when you have to use a superstructure out of metal for scoliosis management.
Wow, Alan, that is super crazy to even think about really all the skills that have been lost with metal bending and leather, and not that I miss those days, but man, it was truly craftsmanship. Are you able to share a little bit about when thermoplastics started coming into the industry?
We developed the first polypropylene prefabricated AFOs back in the late 60s, early 70s. And I created a product line out of that, the posterior leaf spring orthoses, that is still being manufactured by BioSculptor, which originally was called Merimed Precision Corporation, and that was absorbed by BioSculptor, and those products are still being made. And oddly enough, they're still being made off the same molds that I developed that many years ago. At the all-time high in scoliosis treatment, which was 1982 to 1984, a close orthopedic friend of mine told me I better start looking at doing something else because the amount of bracing that was going to be done is going to be curbed via the new surgical procedures that were coming on board, i.e. the CD, the Cottrell-Dubose procedures of spinal instrumentation, which was a significant breakthrough over the rod procedures that were being done at the time. So I was doing about 450 cases a year of scoliosis devices, about 250 for idiopathic scoliosis and about 200 for post-op jackets. That's another thing we did. Instead of putting them in plaster cast post-op for the Harrington rod procedures, I developed a way for anterior-posterior clamshell polyethylene-type jacket that was non-removable. What we would do, they would do the first immobilization in plaster, and in about 3 to 4 weeks, I would cast these patients in a supine position for a non-removable body jacket. And the way we made them non-removable, Fillerauer had a rivet at the time that was plastic, and you could use that rivet and heat the cut end of it, and it would expand, and you couldn't remove it. And the only way you could remove the rivets was to be able to cut it. So the children would not be able to take their TLSO off. They were able to shower and dry off, you know, because we'd have a big belly opening there, and they could feed their towel down through it and powder the skin, and we never saw any more skin problems that we were getting from the plaster cast. So I was a doctor I was working with, Dr. Harry Shuffelbarger, who later became the president of the SRS, the Scoliosis Research Society. His method was to operate on them on on a usually a Friday, and I would go in, and we had begin to get into CAD/CAM and so forth, and talk about that a little later. We would scan those patients, and I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself there. You probably want to strike that. We would actually cast those patients in a supine position and have the TLSOs ready for Thursday or Friday of that week and fit them on a Friday. And the nurses would get those patients up and walking over the weekend, and they were discharged on a Monday. It was a major breakthrough and a significant savings in cost for the paying agencies that they had. And we developed the casting procedure, the supine casting procedures, which we would use with a vacuum bag on the posterior of the child in a laying down position. And we would body roll, we would pull vacuum on that bag, vacuum bean bag type of thing. And we fabricated those out of a special membrane that was really a great material to use. And then we would lay layers of the plaster bandage in that, log roll them back over, and then do an anterior posterior lapping of the plaster from left to right or right to left. And we would indicate that and separate the two and pour the models from there. Roughly, we were doing eight and a half TLSOs a week. I was, to meet the doctor's schedule, I was getting home at 10 or 11 o'clock at night to turn out that amount of cases. That's BC also, before computers, and pouring these heavy casts and et cetera, and then forming over those models.
Let's have a chat, because it sounds like kind of the, at least from what I've heard from some of my friends that have been around in the field a little bit, the 80s was kind of a heyday of significant improvements. Not only did you have some of the scanning stuff come into be, the, you know, definitely use of thermoplastics and carbon fiber, or at least lamination, not necessarily carbon fiber, and then some of the advancements. I think some people would love to hear about your relationship with Sablich and Guth, as well as you did the CAD/CAM stuff.
Well, I think, let me think which comes first here. Actually, it rolls right into that about the CAT, CATCAM group, because let me finish the TLSO, which will be real quick.
Okay.
My pediatric orthopedic surgeon friend came to me in 1982, I think it was, and he said, you better start doing something else, because the amount of TLSOs you're doing is going to be cut down significantly with the use of a new surgical procedure that came out of France by two doctors, Cottrell and Dubosay. And Cottrell was the master of scoliosis in Europe at the time, and Dubosay was the understudy, and they developed a hardware system that was extremely stable and didn't require post-op casting and so forth in TLSOs. And also they were switching over to more surgery because the clinical results they were getting from bracing was not really that good at that time. So we went from doing 450 cases a year to 40 in about a year and a half time frame. And I was sitting there twiddling my thumbs as to what should I do next. Well, it just so happens that John Savalich began to popularize the CAT CAM socket. That's CATCAM, not to be confused with CAD CAM socket. It stood for Controlled Adducted Trochanteric Controlled Alignment Method. And he had a friend, Tom Guth, that those two were childhood buddies, and both of them later became prosthetists and orthotists. And there was a guy from Miami named George Deponest, who was a kind of a promoter type person. And somehow he got interested in helping kids and particularly amputees. And being in Miami, he had contacted me and got me involved in snow skiing in Colorado. And ultimately, I became a team prosthetist for about 25 years, taking care of these different kids and the disabled ski team. So I went from doing a lot of orthotics to doing a lot of prosthetics at that time, and specifically designing new stuff that the skiers could use, because there was no prosthetist involved at the time, and there was no prosthetist that was going up on a mountain with these kids to see what they actually needed, what kind of improvements they needed. So I became involved in that for quite a while. And
is that where you met Joe Johnson? Was on the ski thing?
Yes, and it's exactly where he was. He was on the U.S. disabled ski team at that time. Yeah, that's where I met Joey. Those days were unbelievable. The esprit de corps with these guys, they were guys and gals, both. I mean, just tremendous athletes. They were just as dedicated athletes as any Olympian. They trained year round, and what a phenomenal group of people they were. I mean, it was really, really something. And I was very happy to be involved with it. We did significant amount of video during those days. I had a video department with full-time people in video, and I would go out on the mountain lugging these big cameras around, and my wife would be the grip, and she would carry the tripods, and we'd do all kinds of videos of these people and so forth. So it was a great time, and I was very happy to be involved in that type of program. The training, the skiing, the instructors, the ski lift cost, everything was no charge. The ski racing actually was stimulated out of that program. Since my interest was in materials and plastics, we were doing a lot of plastic type prosthetics being laminated and or with thermoplastics. And I came up with the idea, and I didn't know what the plastic was from the dental field. They had the dentists would make these clear, flexible inserts to prevent people from grinding their teeth at night. And I looked at that plastic, and I said, oh, this is pretty unique. And it took me a long time, because we had no internet, you know, no ability to find out where you can do almost instantly whatever materials you want today. I found out what that material was. Basically, it's the EVA that is used today to make a lot of flexible socket system. So we started initially, before I got to that stage, we were using low-density polyethylene for the socket material and then laminating a frame over the top of that. And when we found this material, the problem was I couldn't find it in the sizes that we needed, because there was only one or two people that were extruding this material and nobody was making thick wall plastic to do it. Now it's readily available. So one of the main things that came out of prosthetic development in those days, I had one of the ski members was a transtibial amputee, and he was a contractor, and he was up on a roof and fell off the roof, broke his leg severely, and ultimately ended up with an amputee. Well, he was an excellent skier to begin with, and then became a skier and a member of the U.S. disabled team. And a lot of these guys would fly down to Miami to get their work done. And so he had his the typical system that we were using was a silicone. I actually developed a silicone rubber insert or liner, as you would call it today. And we would laminate those and then do a polyester laminate over the top of that. And he had put some weight on, so he couldn't get back to Miami. So in order to wear his leg, he would lube up with Vaseline and stick his leg into the silicone liner, which was a laminated liner. And voila, he created, by accident, a suction socket transtibial prosthesis. So I looked at that and I said, wow. I said, first of all, never ever use Vaseline, and particularly in our climate, it would eat a patient's residual limb up because it doesn't transfer the evaporate the water or the perspiration and would cause significant skin problem. So I started looking at this, and then we started playing with it and making a lot of skin-tight prostheses, and then ultimately came up with using suspension sleeves. And today we've developed a umbrella valve vacuum plate that expels the air from the socket. That component part is made by Bulldog. He's done a lot of good work for me and design stuff that I wanted done. And that component is available from them. And it's a one-way valve, but there's no hole in the socket. And there's nothing to get clogged because of the way that it's made. It's a really good way to create a vacuum-assisted socket. We did tests. My son did tests. He instrumented a vacuum gauge into a socket and was able to pull by just compression and socket design nine inches of mercury without any type of pump system whatsoever. So my opinion of needing vacuum assisted pumps, whether they're manual or a bleeder pump or electric, I don't think it is necessary, because if you get over between 9 and 10 inches of mercury pulling vacuum on somebody's limb, they're not going to tolerate it for very long. I'd say the average probably is maybe 3 to 6 pounds of mercury on the average person that's walking. Well, to me, that was a major breakthrough in transtibial prostheses, along with the ability of using homopolymer polypropylene, because it's compliant. It moves with the patient. It's not as rigid as a laminate, and particularly as rigid as a carbon fiber. So it has the ability to oil can and not be as rigid a structure as we've seen with thermoset plastics. A part of the procedure is doing a silicone distal injection with the patient standing under compression, which creates a perfect total contact, which was another major breakthrough of prosthetics for successfully ending the problem with distal end breakdown from developing verrucous hypoplasia. And this, to this day, I don't see the field of prosthetics using this type of technology. I developed that as a student at Northwestern, along with my memory is fading here, a Canadian prosthetist that came down from Canada and joined Northwestern. I'll think of his name here in a minute. But when I was going to Northwestern, I get through with my work, and this is in the old building. So research and development was down in the basement. I'd go down there and work down there, and that's where I really learned a lot. Fred Hampton was the prosthetist involved. He was an instructor at Northwestern and a research prosthetist, really super guy. He was great, very intuitive, had a lot to offer. I learned a lot from him, particularly with when we developed the silicone injection and his knowledge of true hip prosthetics, the quote-unquote Canadian hip disarticulation. Followed him to Northwestern, and then they improved on it. Now you have a great deal more capability with component parts and et cetera for true hips or hemipelvectomies today. I would like to see the prosthetist use distal end injections a great deal more. You can use those with pins, which I don't care for at all. I do not like pin suspensions for a number of reasons. I won't go into detail about that, but with the use of vacuum assisted non-component transtibials and silicone distal injection, it is a really good way to fit transtibials, and you will not see distal end problems occur if you keep that patient in fit. Now, one of the advantages you have, if a patient goes in too deep, you can re-inject them because you have a built-in void there and eliminate the problems with distal end problems of either pressure problems or lack of total contact or creating varicose hyperplasia. They're highly adjustable. What we use in the silicone application is a mixture of 60% silicone rubber and 40% silicone foam. So and you can vary that densities. You can go 50-50, 40-60, whatever you need to do to fit the distal end of the prosthesis. And you will actually see many of the problems go away that amputees and prosthetists are seeing with the distal end of the limb.
I think one of the cool things that you talk about is compliant sockets, so using the polypropylene, and then also having a very dynamic distal end that's injectable. So I think that's really neat. I'd like for you to take us down a little bit. So that's the transtibial side. You mentioned a little bit about the pins and suction. Some of your work in the CAT-CAM stuff and then some of the stuff that you've developed with transfemorals, I think would be interesting to our listeners. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about some of your maybe transfemoral philosophy.
Okay. Getting the group put together with the help of George Stepanis and John Sablich is I joined, so to speak, it was just a loose-knit group of three people of Sablich, Guth, and I joined it because I had this material knowledge that they didn't have. And about the time that I joined that, we had started the development of CAD-CAM, C-A-D-C-A-M, Computer Automated Design, Computer-Aided Manufacturing. And we were playing around with different ways to digitize. And then shortly after that, I don't remember whether it was George Stepanis or John Sablich, there was a prosthetist in New York that was very progressive, and they wanted him to join it and wanted me to kind of mentor him a little bit to do it. And that fellow's name was Glenn Hudnick. And so there were four of us involved with a CAT. We called it the CAT CAM Research Society. And we would meet by phone, you know, maybe every month or so, and give results and different things that we were doing and so forth. And that's how it progressed. And John Sablich, the way he became involved with it, he had heard about this fellow in Denver, Colorado, Ivan Long. And Ivan had come up with his concept of Long's line, and he wasn't a proponent of quadrilateral sockets. And so John went out and spent some time with him and learned his technique. And Long did not use any alignment couplings whatsoever. He did everything by eye. And he still had ischial bearing on his socket design, but he was really the grandfather of trying to keep the femur really in a adducted position. So John went out there and spent some time with him, and then came back and started experimenting and so forth. And again, John was a lot more progressive than Ivan was, but he took some of Ivan's concepts and so forth, and he developed what he called the CATCAM socket. So between the four of us, we progressed in doing this type of work, and they all started going over to the soft material, which is EVA, ethyl vinyl alcohol. It's an offshoot of polypropylene. And of course, that today is now readily available under different product names and so forth. There's, to my knowledge, there's only a couple of people that are extruding it. One in, I think it's in Belgium, and the other one is up in the Massachusetts area, if they're still making it, I'm not sure. But that was a major breakthrough in materials. I evolved from the CAT-CAM socket to the Ramus containment socket, because my feeling is unless you contain a ramus, you cannot control the adduction of the femur. And we did a number of studies with X-ray, anterior posterior X-ray, lateral X-ray, and the way we would take these X-rays, we would take the brim of the socket and tape regular solder wire around that because it had lead in it. And then we'd have the X-ray taken to see if we were encapsulating the ramus within the socket. This, to me, was a major breakthrough also for transfemoral amputees, because if you can contain the ascending ramus in the socket to the greater trochanter, that dimension, which is really not a measurable, almost everything on a transfemoral, in my viewpoint, is not a very accurate means of measurement. And I can get into that for a minute. But we were able to prove that without the containment of the ramus within the socket, you could not move the femur, keep the femur in an adducted position. If you're able to keep the femur in an adducted position, you can improve the gait of a transfemoral considerably, and in many instances, eliminate the Trendelenburg type gait. One of the studies that we did I haven't gotten into fracture bracing yet, but that comes later. One of the studies we did, which even gave me more knowledge to say, how are we going to stabilize that femur in the musculature? I refer to it like a bone in a bowl of Jell-O, to stabilize that femur in a ML and AP plane to give the patient the power needed to ambulate well. Well, in our fracture brace studies, we had a fresh hip disarticulation amputee. And so Lauren Latta, Dr. Latta, who's a PhD mechanical engineer with the University of Miami, what we did is we instrumented a intermedullary nail in the femur of this amputated leg. And we were trying to develop a means of how to keep the proximal femur from moving around within a fracture brace. So the first thing we did is we just instrumented it in there, and it was almost like a gear shift lever. We wrapped the dead leg in plaster, and we wrapped the dead leg in plastic, thermoformable, that synthetic balata material that Johnson & Johnson used to make. And there was no way that we could stabilize the femur. But bearing in mind that there's a disrupted amputation, we took the head of the femur off and put the IM nail in there, and we were able to move that femur in the musculature all over the place. You couldn't stabilize it. So we soon figured out that there was no way to stabilize it. So I looked at that study and I said, let's look at the other aspect of it. When they do the amputation as a transfemoral, that the musculature, dependence on the level of you know, what's remaining and how the residual, the muscles were tied off and what was remaining, how can we stabilize that femur in the remaining musculature? Well, the first thing you've got to do is stabilize the top of the socket. And the top of the socket has to be stabilized so it won't move laterally. And by the design of the ramus containment socket and the pocketing for the musculature to drop down inside the socket and not roll the socket over, which is what the prosthetist traditionally does now. And the more he rolls it over, the less he has control of the socket shifting laterally. And if you go back in history, when before suction sockets with hip controls, the hip control stabilized the patient in the socket because it allowed them to keep the prosthesis underneath in the anatomical position that it should be in a normal ambulation. So a lot of hip control prosthetic cases did pretty good. They didn't have, they pistoned a lot, but they had lateral stability. So what we did was a anatomical design to stabilize the femur in the socket by controlling the displacement of the socket in the ML plane and to stabilize the femur in an anterior posterior plane by using the femoral iliotibial channel, i.e. known as the wallet hollow, and to stabilize the femur in that position and to put the gluteus medius on stretch so that the patient would have the power of extension. And it was dramatic, the difference that we were getting in gait of these patients, and particularly on the shorter amputations, because if you did x-ray studies, which we did, almost all of these cases, whether short or long, or particularly the short ones, were all in an abducted position. So if you think about the gluteus medius, if it's not on stretch, it can't support the patient during mid-stance. And the only way they can get through with that is by changing their center weight of gravity and putting that over the in the alignment of the femur, i.e. Trendelenburg-type gait. So that became a major breakthrough that we use today in fitting almost all transfemoral amputees. And the technique there is to make a PET socket that encapsulates the pelvis within the socket. The fitting and the dimensions are critical in the fit channel and the compression of tissue, which is very slight. These are not tight fitting sockets. And we put that on a standing fixture with a Endolite ankle on it using the old UCB casting stand, which are no longer available. You can get a stand from Otto Bock, which is a really nice one. Expensive, but very nice. And we do the old Otto Bock standing procedure of shifting weight four and a half, and doing a simulated dynamic alignment in the diagnostic socket. That diagnostic socket also has a distal end void in it, which we do a distal end silicone injection with it. And from that, currently, we are still having to pour a plaster model, but very shortly, we will be digitizing the inside of that socket to make a model in CAD-CAM, and therefore we can compensate for the shrinkage in material and in girth and length. And I think that's very important as we get into the other material applications other than the ones that we are currently using with shrink factors and growth factors of plaster and shrink factors of plastic. And the shrink factors are very controllable in CAD-CAM because you can compensate for this with percentages and or girth and length measurements in the model. It's easy to do it into CAD, but it's very difficult to try to hand do it. It's near impossible because if you look at a shrink factor of a polypropylene socket, the shrink on inch by inch, which is a engineering term of a cube of plastic, it shrinks 0.075 inch per inch shrinkage. So if you take a 10-inch limb, that socket, when you form it, will shrink 0.375 inch in 10 inches. And you have to compensate for those things. All plastic engineering, and I use an example of a plastic bottle, which is usually PETG, and then a cap that goes on it. The engineers in the tool design so that the threads on the bottle and the threads on the cap, which are two different materials, they calculate the shrink of those two different materials. So when that cap is screwed onto that bottle, it fits and it doesn't leak. Our training in P&O does not get into enough of the engineering sciences to apply this to prosthetics and orthotics. That's a whole nother subject.
So what would you say is the biggest difference between what you were doing and what Ivan Long was doing? Because he was, you know, I've seen some of those old pictures, you know, significantly doing adduction of the femur. I remember him famously saying he doesn't even know where the tuberosity is or the ischium, but he knew that it was in there somewhere at some time. So what would you say is the biggest difference between what you were doing and what he was doing?
Well, it's significant. Ivan Long's socket was an oval, and which is really the shape of, you know, a normal, not real flabby limb, but a normal residual limb. If you look at your leg, it's kind of oval in shape. He had an oval shape, but he had ischial bearing on its shape. And the reason that Ivan's success, or the a real good reason for his success early on, was this. And I used to go out to Fitzsimmons and teach at the O&P facility out there run by the Army. Look at the class of amputees that Ivan was seeing. These were 18 to 23, 24-year-old, very healthy, normal males that were war injured, traumatic amputees. And those guys were extremely well muscled, usually, from their amputation, you know, before their amputations. So what happened is that he would do their prosthetic rehabilitation out there, and then they would end up being discharged, go to the VAs in their respected areas of wherever they live, and consequently, they started getting into problems, and the problems were they were still atrophying the hamstring significantly in that design. And so they were also, his sockets were open-ended sockets initially. I think, and I don't remember this because I really never met him, but all of his cases were healthy young people. 65% of the cases that are seen by our colleagues and ourselves are due to disease of some sort, and trauma is the lowest part of them. So once these patients would atrophy their hamstrings, and they started, because they had no containment, the femurs were going into adduction, and there was no means of really controlling them. So the college came up with the concept of his, I'm not sure what he called it. I think he called it the Savalich triangle. He tried to kind of emulate a triangle coming down the medial side of the residual limb, which was still soft tissue. And what I am doing is stabilize, not weight bearing, but stabilizing medially on the ramus, so the socket cannot move laterally. And the other thing that Long did, he had a horse or cow nippers that he would go in on every socket that he casted and nip off an inch, 2 inches of plaster on the lateral side. So fitting the lateral wall. Well, these were muscular patients, okay? So that would last for a little bit, but the minute they begin to atrophy, they would start displacing laterally. And again, you would see the lateral, posterior, distal, bursas occurring on the femurs because the gluteus medius was contracting at mid-stance, pulling the femur in an abducted posterior position. By the way, this is a pearl that I can give you. We use the TKA line in our education, and that's a misnomer in my opinion, because if you will palpate the greater trochanter of an above knee amputee, it is not in the center of the residual limb. It's posterior. And the reason it's posterior is because of the interruption of the weight of the leg being gone and the amputation. So the external rotators are taking place and the trochanter is posterior. If you look at one of our sockets, you cannot use the center of the socket because the center of the socket, looking down the bore of the socket, makes the placement of the TKA line way too far posterior to the actual anatomy. And what I use on my lateral placement of my initial alignment is the body mass of where I think the center weight of gravity. And to kind of explain that, if you got somebody with a beer belly, the center mass is much further forward. Or if you got a skinny guy with a size 13 foot, your center mass is different between those two people. So that lateral line, I'm saying, is body mass, not TKA. And that makes a whole difference. During the fitting stage of the diagnostic socket in a stand, after we get through with that, we take a laser leveler, not anything that's expensive. You can get them at Costco, Home Depot, and we drop a anterior and posterior line from the diagnostic socket with the patient bearing slightly more weight on the amputated side, and drop that down to a piece of masking tape on the floor. So we set where we know where the rotation is going to be, and the anterior posterior lines match up. And then we do a lateral line using body mass of where the anterior posterior placement is going to be. And that's transferred over into the CAD program for your dynamic alignment. And I would say if the socket is fitting properly and not displacing, your dynamic alignment is within 1 to 2 degrees in ML, AP, and AP lateral, AP shifting of where the placement of the knee is. And of course, that's a variable because of the different knees that are available today. But that's how we do it. So when I bolt this whole thing together, which is an erector set, so to speak, I'm not doing a lot of dynamic alignment. And my joy in life is to see how close I can get each one of these things with very little effort in dynamic alignment.
So I think that's pretty neat, because it sounds like essentially what you're doing is you're pre-positioning everything, gathering all that data up front, and then on the backside, you're not having to work as hard. So I think that's pretty neat.
This is, Brent, we haven't gotten into that part of it yet, but with all the, and I got involved in material deposition 30 years ago or better. The method of manufacturing, we'll get into that, but I'll talk about it right now, since on the position and the digitization of the body segment is very important. And then the key that is missing in digital prosthetics and orthotics is the modification or shape manipulation and all the detail that needs to go into that before it then goes into the manufacturing process, being milling of a model, a positive model, and forming over the model, or milling of a model of actually cutting out of the material, or doing the post-processing of all the unique design capabilities that you have now with material deposition or 3D printing. The end result coming out, and you can, the beauty about this is you can compensate for all the different materials and the designs that you want, but the basic prosthetic design, unfortunately, in what I'm seeing, is missing. And the schools are not teaching it. We need to advance our educational program and look at the concept of the prosthetic design. That's the critical part that's missing, that will be the icing on the cake in the future of all of these new processes and new materials, where you can vary the thicknesses, the design of the materials, the different materials that go into the soft, the hard, and actually produce a socket that is going to be a screw together system with various component parts that will aid the prosthetist and ultimately the patient a much better system than what we're doing now overall. That's the goal. That's what I would like to see. But the profession of P&O is very, very slow to accept change. To me, we're on the verge of significant technological advances if we can fill that void from digitization to the post-processing of how that product is going to be made. That design of that model is critical.
You were definitely an early adopter of the technology itself, digitization, but you never got away from just the basics of alignment, socket shape, and really being curious along that. So I guess in a way, the technology and the, for lack of a better term, art, medical, science, whatever, has to go together. The technology will definitely help, but it is not the end-all be-all. It's not going to make you a good prosthetist. A good prosthetist, you have to start with some of the basics of all the alignment, shape capture, and all that. Would you agree, disagree with that?
No, absolutely. I think that's key. And that's, in my viewpoint, and one of my interview processes that I look at in interviewing a prosthetist or orthotist for a position, is I like to see, send me a couple of your check sockets, a transfemoral and a transtibial. And that tells me exactly where the person is coming from, what his concept or his knowledge is from that point. You can see that of what they're dealing with. And unfortunately, our educational programs are such that they're still primarily teaching casting, and whether the cast is with plaster or whether it's with plastic and then pouring a model. They don't understand that the first plastic wrap expands, and then filling that, I said plastic, I mean plaster expands. Then the second plaster expands of pouring the model, and that isn't even being taught. And that's basic 101 tool making. And you can go on U.S. Gypsum's site and get all the information on the variations of plaster that's out there. But you can't get the data sheets on a plaster wrap, a plaster bandage, or a plastic bandage. They won't give you that. Either they don't have it, or they won't give you the information because they don't deal with that. Because that plaster wrap was not designed for prosthetics and orthotics, nor was the plastic one. So the doctor didn't even get into that. But I know that you put a plaster cast on before, and if it's gone through its endothermic reaction and setting down and it gets hot, you come in and you can stick your hand inside that plaster. What happened? Well, a couple of things happened. Number one, the heat probably reduced the fluid in the limb. And the other thing is that the plaster expanded. And if you go in U.S. Gypsum's site, you'll see under the different plasters that are available. And if you ask a prosthetist which one he uses, he doesn't even know. The one that I poured in out of the 100-pound sack of plaster. So that there's a lot more science to this, and engineering science, which I feel the educational programs need to teach a lot more of those concepts so that our prosthetists and orthotists coming out have an overall knowledge of that to do it. And then they can apply their prosthetic skills to designing the model that the orthoses or prostheses is made from. But where the rubber meets the road is, what's the success that they have with the patients? And to me, being an old timer, I think there are more prosthetic problems that have been created by prosthetists than the field probably wants to accept. I think there's the need for probably a cross between evolution and revolution that change our educational programs.
When I look through some of the history of stuff, we've talked a lot about digital fabrication. Or traditional fabrication. We've touched on the digital stuff. But I mean, the reality is you were at the forefront of this, you know, definitely in the 80s. And so can you just take us through your journey starting, it looks like in about the mid 80s with scanning and some of that early scanning stuff that you did to starting up BioSculptor and, you know, and how that actually has changed.
Well, early on, the first digitizer that we had was a sonic air digitizer. I still have, I think, videos, and I got a wealth of videos and so forth because we had our own video department at the time. But the way that this worked is we had a 5-foot by 5-foot frame that we built, an aluminum frame that we attached to the ceiling. And in each corner of the frame was a microphone system. I don't even remember the name of the system that we used. And then we had a probe with probably an 8-inch by 3/16 of an inch brass rod with a sharp point on the end. And then the electronics part of it would send a sound down that probe and the four microphones over the head, overhead rather, would pick up the distance of the surface of the digitization of the model that we were digitizing. And that was the first thing that we started to design with. The problem was you needed a soundproof room, so to speak. And when the air conditioner would kick in, we had cooler air in one level than the other area. And to get really good digitized models or surfaces was next to an impossibility. So the next thing that we came up with was a company called Pohemus. Their product line is tracking things in space. And they had a system called FastScan. And they had a transmitter and receiver. And you could digitize on the surface. We had kind of like a little hockey puck, not a hockey puck, but a little plastic thing that we had. I started out using CAST because I knew my colleagues they were too slow to pick up on digitizing the surface of their residual limb. They had to still play with plaster or plastic wrap. So what we did is we did it both ways. We digitized the residual, we started with transtibial. We digitize the surface of that, and then we take a cast, and I had an adapter on that, the little puck type of thing. Then we go inside the cast, and we digitize the inside of the cast. And that was really a major breakthrough for us because we were able to get a reasonable facsimile of the residual limb. And we would then put that into BioSculptor and do the shape manipulation and then hand vacuum form it and so forth. Well, prior to that, along with all this development, Miramed Precision, I got involved in commercial vacuum forming, and we were vacuum forming all kinds of stuff. Automotive parts and parts for different housings and things like that. So I had commercial vacuum forming equipment, plus the fact the different materials that we used commercially, and also had the ability to go to extruders to get materials made to our specs. So that was trying to control thermoplastics in those days was a problem. The other problem, a big problem, was we were starting to write software with very limited computer capabilities. The first computers we started with were 386s, and then the computer industry had this major breakthrough on a 486. That was considered a rocket ship. This is back around 88, 89, something like that. And I paid $10,500 for a 486 computer. That was a lot of money in those days.
That was a lot of money.
Look what you can buy today for a computer. I mean, your telephone has more power in it than the computers we were working with. So all of our stuff initially was done in DOS. And then we slowly switched over to Windows later on. And then we developed some specialized, we did a lot of specialized programming for different companies. We built systems for knees. We built them for all kinds of different stuff to kind of spread the cost of this thing over a period of time. But the next phase of digitizing was, again, a laser scanner. And that scanner was made by a company in New Zealand. And it was a joint effort between Prohemus and Arantz, which was the Prohemus was up in the Northeast. I think they're in New Hampshire, Connecticut. And the Arantz people are in New Zealand. They first came out with this big wand, which looked like maybe 20 inches from end to end with two cameras in it. And we got a hold of one of those and started digitizing. And the problem was not the scanner, but Windows, I can't remember the name, ST or Windows, something like that, which was a terrible program. And we didn't get very good results out of it. And then finally, Windows came out with their first Windows. I don't think it had a number after it. But we were able to get some results with that. And Arantz had defined the scanner and made it much more compact. And we preferred the twin camera system because of scanning around objects where when you would go around like a body jacket or something, or go around a residual limb, where the line of sight from the laser to the camera was lost with a single camera system, it would pick it up with a twin camera system. It would see it either from one or the other, but not both. But it was an automatic transfer of data that was coming in. And to this day, the old Poema scanners, Arantz scanners, have better advantages than the new ones, but you can't get those anymore. And I think the scanner technology has now gone in leaps and bounds into white light scanning, and there's just the scanning technology is going in leaps and bounds right now. I mean, you and I have discussed this. We're using a scanner now that has professional qualities to it for under $1,000. The problem with all of these is, again, how to use them and how to use it for P&O so that you can get the results. The accuracy of them is far superior to anything you can do by hand, and, you know, like hand casting and so forth. And there's a significant difference in the scanners and the cheaper LiDAR systems that are out there, Apple system, for an example. If you look at scans coming from the LiDAR system compared to professional scanners, it's night and day. And the accuracy is night and day also. So I suspect in the next couple of years, scanning technology is going to change considerably. And people getting into this ought to consider the investment of these scanners. The equipment is negligible. The real investment is your learning curve and your technology and where to go to learn how to do this stuff. And unfortunately, that's a limited area to go to today. And you know, your commitment to helping prosthetists and orthotists learn something about these technologies is a breath of fresh air. And I enjoy watching and seeing everybody doing their kind of own thing. But the industry, either in itself or a change in some of the regulations of INCO, for the schools to start putting in the equipment and educate their their professors and teaching this stuff really needs to be done, because I feel our students that are going into this are being shortchanged in their educational background. They say they don't have time to teach anything else but what INCOPE is outlined for them. Well, I don't believe that. But there's a similar resistance, by the way, in the dental industry also. I mean, CAD-CAM has been around in dentistry for a long time. My dentist is on his third CAD system, you know, as they've improved it. I can tell you, being a recipient of this, I can go in and have him digitize my mouth, do his modification, and have that crown in my mouth in about an hour and 15 minutes. Done. You know, the investment is, you know, I don't know what one of those things costs, probably in $100,000 or so. But the dental field is beginning to switch over to doing some of this stuff also.
Yeah.
So I think maybe a group of people like yourself and the interested people that are working in this arena should probably get together to write the programs, because the schools aren't going to do it. This is going to come from the profession. Most of the developments today come from the profession or the manufacturers getting into it, but they're designing stuff for their particular needs, not particularly for you.
Well, hey, thanks, Alan, for taking the time out of your day. We've gone a long time. You've shared a bunch of stuff, and I really appreciate that. I love hearing the history of not only some of the socket design, but even some of the concepts that comes out of spinal and fracture bracing, and then obviously transfemoral sockets. And then you talking about some of the people that we read about in books, you know, Guth and Long and that sort of thing. So I appreciate your time and sharing your knowledge with us today.
Well, you're very welcome, and I hope that I can be an asset to the future of P&O.
All right. And thank you for listening to the Orthotics and Prosthetics podcast, and we'll catch you next time.